This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 16th of December, 2015, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the Republican Party circus descends on the only city in the United States in which it would appear a relatively staid and sensible evening's entertainment. We'll ask who won big in Las Vegas and who lost their shirt. I'll be joined by three Monocle bureau chiefs, Thomas Lewis, Ed Stocker and James Chambers, to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including...
No relationship is more important to me and to Canada than the one with First Nations, the Métis Nation, and Inuit peoples. Let me say it once again. I give you my word that we will renew and respect that relationship.
Justin Trudeau's outreach to Canada's Indigenous peoples, China's somewhat ominous suggestions about regulating the internet, and the reasons why one Russian city wants to send a cat to City Hall. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And you are welcome to Midori House. My guests today on this special program, given that everybody's in town for Christmas, are Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis, New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker, and Hong Kong Bureau Chief James Chambers. We are going to start in Las Vegas, where in normal circumstances, a ludicrous pantomime featuring a cast of has-been show-offs and attention seekers with silly hair and too much makeup would be of little interest beyond local listings magazines. But when one of the show's stars will spend next year campaigning to occupy the planet's most powerful office, it assumes somewhat greater importance. So we will now take a look at last night's Republican debate at the Venetian Hotel. Ed, I suppose we should start with you, our New York bureau chief. Did anything in particular leap out at you?
Well, I think it was interesting to see that Trump actually didn't dominate quite as much as he has in the past. Incredible to think that we're just under a year away, 11 months, in fact, from the presidential elections, and we've already had five Republican debates.
Is it only five?
Only five.
It seems like several times that number already.
Well, there's lots more to come. Don't worry about
good.
That.
Well worth staying alive for.
So Trump didn't get quite as much of the limelight as he has done in the past. Jeb Bush, one of the few candidates to actually go on the offensive against Trump, the rest of them running scared of doing that. He called Trump a chaos president, basically saying that, trying to discredit him and saying that he would make a disastrous commander-in-chief. And then another highlight, if you will, was the spat between Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz on that thorny issue in the US at the moment on immigration.
Just to follow that up, Ed, it struck me that there was surprisingly little talk of, I lose track of which week, corresponds with which stupid idea of Donald Trump's. I think the banning Muslims one, was that this week or last week? It was something like that. There was very little talk of that. Why?
He did defend himself on that.
But as you point out, it's really only Jeb Bush who started beating him up directly. Why just him? What's everyone else still scared of?
Well, I think Ted Cruz wants to make sure he doesn't alienate those supporters of Trump. If Trump doesn't win the candidacy, he wants to win over the people that were with Trump. So he's, scared of alienating those voters. And I think that's the same with all the others as well. Jeb Bush is doing awfully, to put it lightly, and he's choosing to go for a tactic that he thinks may work, or maybe it's a last-ditch effort to stay in the race. I think it's interesting to see that, whatever Trump is doing doesn't manage to bring him down. Despite his comments about barring all Muslims from entering the US, he's still in the race and he's still leading with 42%, according to one poll.
Interestingly, though, Thomas, there's been a few other shifts in the polls and in the odds. The field's obvious other Yahoo candidate, Ben Carson, has drifted out into irrelevance. Odds are shortening quite dramatically on Marco Rubio, and there's now a lot of money starting to come in for Chris Christie as well. What did you make of him?
I think the Chris Christie story is actually really quite interesting. I lived in the US in 2012 and reported on the re-election campaign of President Obama then. And I remember, following Mitt Romney's candidacy fairly closely. And after his defeat, John McCain, who of course stood in 2008, came out and said, we've had so many TV debates where actually we've all torn each other apart, and actually we did have a candidate on paper could quite easily have won, a president who was doing very poorly in the opinion polls at the time. But the relentless nature of these TV debates, frankly, just, you know, made him, when he actually got to the candidacy, well, look, you know, fairly sort of, you know, having to sort of claw back from a fairly sort of far distance. The only reason I sort of mention this is because I think for Chris Christie, having so many debates might actually be a bit of an advantage. You have, you know, everyone looking at the Jeb Bush, you know, sort of catastrophe really quietly unfolding. You have Donald Trump, of course, that kind of bandwagon rolling on. I think with the Christies and the Rubios of this race, you know, if Mitt Romney had to basically sort of release himself of everything that would have appealed to a Democratic voter, actually they might be able to sort of, you know, do sort of the reverse, if you like, and actually hold their ground and just be the quiet kind of opposition to, say, the Donald Trumps and to the sort of madder voices in this contest.
Well, this is the bind that the Republicans seem to have gotten themselves into, certainly in this election and the previous one and arguably the one before that, that you have to spend 2 years pretending to be crazy to actually get the nomination, by which time you have alienated everybody to the right of you whose votes you're going to need to win the White House.
And it's just unfathomable to me, actually. I mean, I think the big takeaway, you know, the defeat in 2012 really hurt, really pretty badly for the Republican Party. They couldn't believe that they'd lost this race, that really they should and could have won, I think. And I think, you know, for you know, interested observers kind of looking at this time around, you know, maybe, you know, the thought was that you were going to have maybe a bit more of a tempered kind of voice, a more sort of, you know, reasonable debate. I mean, that hasn't really, I mean, the number of candidates so far for the Republican side and all the sort of, you know, madness, as I said, of some of the stances being taken on things, I think it's quite disheartening to a lot of people that actually it seems to be entrenching itself further rather than actually trying to learn some of the lessons of this gridlock of the Obama years from the Republican point of view.
It's because the candidates feel they all need to follow Donald Trump. I mean, we thought it was going to be much more tempered, like you were saying, Thomas, but then Trump got all this traction with some of the things he's been saying. And people are afraid to then go out on a limb and be the opposite to that.
But I think actually, say, maybe, you know, Chris Christie, for example, actually, I don't think they are all jumping on the Trump bandwagon.
Well, he's casting himself as a bit of an outsider. He's going for that.
But as you mentioned, so Andrew,
everybody,
you know,
casts themselves as an outsider. Though. Just a different
type of outsider.
Just once, I want to see a candidate run as just like, I'm a total beltway creature. I am the insider's insider. Ed, I did want to ask you, there is an idea doing the rounds, and it is now getting some traction.
You're
among
Hillary.
Yes, some actual GOP congressmen have mentioned it. Certainly some Republican commentators have actually talked about it in not altogether joking fashion, that Donald Trump is, in fact,
in cahoots,
a Clintonian plant. It's a delicious
idea.
It would
be incredible, wouldn't it? I mean, I think that might be giving Donald Trump a little... I think he's not that good of an actor, is he? Do you think he could be making it all up? He's actually a Democrat with very liberal views deep down.
Well, the thing he has in the past said he is a liberal Democrat.
His
friendship with the Clintons is a matter of public record. They've been to at least one of his weddings.
That's true. But I mean, if you look at U.S. politics, there are lots of friendships across the political divide. Look at George W. Bush and Bill Clinton getting cozy together nowadays. So I don't think that necessarily means that he's deep down a Democrat. I think he's certainly flip-flopped, which kind of fuels the fire of that conspiracy theory. But I think his ego is too big for him ever to be doing this or for someone else.
Okay, well, before we leave this subject, I do just want to go around the table, and I'll bring you in, James, first on this point. Just I want a name from each of you. Who's the Republican nominee?
Well, that's a tough one to bring me in on. I'm hoping myself that the pollsters have got it completely wrong like they did in the UK. I'd hate to have to pick one of these lunatics to win the race, but... And I can't believe I'm going to go for Jeb Bush. It seems like such a strange position to be in.
Ed's shaking his head. Where's your money?
You know what? I think Donald Trump might do it. I really do. Ooh.
Not a chance. Not a chance.
I don't know.
I just don't think it's going to happen.
Well, I mean, maybe Ted Cruz. But I also say that things change so much. Like, 11 months is such a long time in politics, and even more so in US politics. We've seen so many Hollywood-type scripts and so many twists and turns already, and we still have 11 months. There's so many debates, there's so much hype on TV all the time. Things change every week. Look how Carson's dipped, how he was surging before, and he's disappearing fast. even, you know, the way Obama surged through past Hillary Clinton last time, I just think it's very hard to tell. So I'm being a bit of a coward and a cop out there.
Tom?
I mean, it is all about the surprise, isn't it, I suppose? And I suppose the surprise so far is that Donald Trump is actually still kind of
he's
in
still
the race,
there.
It would seem. But I genuinely don't think he will be the Republican candidate. I think maybe Marco Rubio.
Okay. I actually think 10 to 1 on Chris Christie you can still get, which I actually think is pretty decent value.
I'll see you at the bookies later, Andrew.
But we should look now at Canada, where since being sworn in as Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau has won global headlines by taking a generous and compassionate attitude to refugees at notable odds with that on display south of the border. Having welcomed Canada's newest residents, he now seems determined to take a similar line with Canada's oldest. Trudeau has met with 5 Aboriginal organisations following the publication of a report by Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Thomas, as briskly as you can, sum up this report for us. What's in it and why is it so important to Trudeau so early on?
So it's been a six-year process, but bringing together decades and decades more of a fairly grim chapter in Canadian history. Basically, the residential school system is at the heart of this. This is where children from Indigenous Canadian families were removed from their families and put into these residential schools where there were abuses, innumerable, where the conditions were dreadful. And basically, you know, the shorthand of this is that the erosion of the Indigenous culture, languages was basically the goal. And, you know, this has created, for many commentators, really, the sort of dysfunction, really, that many First Nations communities have been victim of ever since this, really. So I think the report today, and, you know, it is important to bring Justin Trudeau in here. The preliminary findings of this report were published in June while his predecessor, Stephen Harper, was still in office. And he was nowhere to be seen. He didn't even make a statement as soon as this came out. And that really gave a pretty negative symbol, really, to the First Nations community and actually to the rest of Canada, who I think maybe haven't really been totally involved in this truth and reconciliation process, that maybe it's felt slightly different. So I think the rhetoric from Trudeau earlier today is really, really very promising. And I think also the way First Nations communities, for example, there's a report today showing that First Nations and Indigenous participation in the federal election this year was higher than it's ever been. You know, traditionally, Indigenous voters don't participate. They answer to the Crown, they feel, and not to the elected officials in Ottawa. So I think, you know, I think Trudeau obviously has gone very big on this as a marker from the government that went before, but I think doing what many Canadians across the spectrum will feel doing is right as well.
Just to follow that up, Tom, you talk about Canadians from across the spectrum. The story you outline there and the dynamic you outline there is fairly familiar to an Australian such as myself, which for many, many years ran not dissimilar policies vis-a-vis the country's own Indigenous population. And Ed, I'm sure the same could be basically said of the United States as well. But is there likely to be any resistance to it in Canada from any serious parts of the political spectrum? Because in Australia, less so than there used to be, but whenever there's talk about reparations or apologies or reconciliation is floated, there's the tendency, honestly, haven't we done enough, et cetera, what more is it going to take, et cetera. Is there any of that kind of impatience in Canadian politics?
I think the short answer is no, actually. I think the momentum behind this now, with this sort of collection of events, I suppose, you had the sort of really surprising outcome of the election in October, you had this report coming out, which you've known was going to come out at around this time. First Nations organisations have been sort of building up to this moment, really. Also announced today by Justin Trudeau was a national inquiry into another, I suppose, related scandal that is widely perceived in Canada about the disappearance and murder of thousands of Indigenous and First Nations women across Canada. I think, you know, therefore, with this kind of new momentum, I think it feels as though the discourse is there and is ripe now. And I think you're not going to get from the Conservatives, who have actually sort of toned down and actually shown that they are going to sort of participate in this kind of process from here on in. I think actually, Andrew, the big challenge will be from, you know, a broader public point of view. you know, do Canadians, you know, if you live in Vancouver or in St. John's or Newfoundland, do you feel that, you know, this is the same nation? Do you feel that the Indigenous experience is the same as the Canadian experience? And I think the answer to many would be no, actually, until now. And I think the key thing will be whether that kind of divide can start to be sort of melded together, I suppose.
Ed, is this another realm in which the Canadian approach is likely to draw unflattering comparisons with the American take on a similar issue?
Well, I mean, it's just, I mean, possibly, yes. I mean, it's certainly something that's not really, that you don't see that in the political discourse in the US. It's not really a theme that comes up, especially with this election cycle that we're in at the moment. I'd say it was very, very far from both American politicians' minds and actually the American public's mind as well. I think, you know, they're more interested in fear-mongering about Syrian refugees coming into the country than anything to do with the Indigenous population, which is probably a pretty sad thing. But that's the way it is at the moment. I think there's a lot of fear in the US at the moment about terrorism and also immigration, and that's being stoked by all the candidates, really, at the moment, on the Republican side anyway.
I mean, I wanted to say that I think, you know, in Canada, if you look at, say, the political sort of imagery of this, you know, Stephen Harper had quite a high-profile minister for the Arctic, who was a First Nations politician. I think, you know, she was quite popular internally. I'm not sure how popular she was kind of in the broader sphere. Justin Trudeau has kind of gone further, and his cabinet is a real array of all sectors of Canadian society. And the Attorney General is a very prominent First Nations activist from Vancouver, has been a lawyer for many of these cases for many years. So I think in terms of incorporating these issues into the fabric of governance, into the fabric of Canadian life, he really has started as he sort of means to go on, really.
Just a final thought on this one from you, Thomas, and if you could keep it relatively brisk so we can deal properly with Russia's attempt to elect a cat as mayor, which I'm very much looking forward to. The Truth and Reconciliation's come up with, I think, 94 calls to action, a historically resonant list of demands, it could be argued. Trudeau says he will implement all of them, and they haven't even needed to nail them to a church door. What is that actually going to mean in practice? Are these largely symbolic promises or symbolic gestures, or is this going to cost actual money?
I think it will cost actual money, yes. And I think, you know, what Trudeau will need to do now, like with many other of Trudeau's policies, points. So if you go back to the Syrian, the approach to Syrian refugees, you know, Trudeau put this into motion very quickly, and within sort of a month, actually, the first Syrian refugees were arriving in Canada. And I think he'll be very keen to do the same thing with these recommendations, too.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. And it was, of course, 95 theses that Martin Luther nailed to a church door in Wartenborg. I was trying a little bit too hard there. I mean, I was in the ballpark. It was somewhere in the mid-90s. We are going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Lewis, Thomas Lewis, Ed Stocker, and James Chambers. Coming up next, China and the internet and that Russian city which wants to elect a cat.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week. With me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
We're raising the curtain on a brand new show here on Monocle 24 devoted to the best in cinema. Tune in every week to hear from filmmakers, critics, and luminaries of the genre as we shine a spotlight on everything from revivals and the restoration of vintage cuts to Hollywood's golden age and the role of the auteur.
I never think of architecture or cities or landscapes in cinema as merely being a kind of neutral backdrop to the action. They are the action themselves.
Hear feature-length interviews with the biggest names, roundtable discussions, special reports, and more as Monocle 24 delves into the rich history of the silver screen. The Cinema Show on Monocle 24, in association with MUBI, premiering Fridays at 20:00 London time, because life is too short for bad films.
And welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are James Chambers, Thomas Lewis and Ed Stocker. It's not easy to be entirely relaxed about the idea of the World Internet Conference being held in China, a country which remains very much in the unpersuaded camp where free expression is concerned. President Xi Jinping, opening proceedings, retreated, as he often does, into bland euphemism about a balance between freedom and order, and made some more pointed remarks to the effect of it being none of anyone else's damn business how China regulated its online sphere or punished rule breakers. James, Reporters Without Borders, for one, has urged a boycott of the conference, given China's record on policing online dissent. Should China really... should we be allowing... I don't know how you stop them, but how much of a role should China be permitted to have in policing the internet?
Well, I guess China is... We have to recognize the significance of China when it comes to the internet, because there's, you know, over 650 million internet users in China. You know, it's over one in five of the world's internet users are in China. And I think every country deserves to have some say in the internet. I think the point that Xi Jinping was making was that up to now, it's been very much a US-led initiative, and they would like to have more say. Obviously, that's alarming in terms of what they would like to do with it, in terms of the kind of censorship angle. But the fact that he's speaking at this conference is indicative of how important it is to them now. Because, you know, last year, I think he sent a letter along to welcome everyone to the conference. This year, he made the keynote address. So it's a clear sign that this is going to become an important thing for him going forward. So they're clearly going to want more and more of a role. I would, looking at it's called the World Internet Conference. I think that's a bit misleading. there was representatives from a lot of China's neighbors. The Russian PM was there, the Pakistani Prime Minister, a lot of the Stans came. I think the guy who gets the award for the most air miles is the Deputy Prime Minister of Tonga. But there was no one from the West. But, you know, as an indication of how important it is commercially, you had a lot of U.S. tech companies sending people along, like the CEOs of Airbnb and Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales was there, and the CEO of Netflix. So, commercially, it's an important place to be. And these American companies are kind of finding out that and realizing that they need to play ball if they want to make some money in China.
Just to pick that up about the importance of the internet to China, or at least the... Just trying to figure out if it's possible to glean from Xi Jinping's speech which way the Chinese Communist Party looks at the internet most, as either a huge economic opportunity, which of course it is, or a potential threat, which obviously it also is to an authoritarian regime. How nervous are they about it still?
Well, I guess the reality of the internet in China is very nuanced. Outside of China, we know that Facebook is banned and Twitter is banned and YouTube is banned and all that kind of stuff. But inside China, they've got their own versions of all these things, like WeChat and all these social media sites. And Chinese netizens, as they call themselves, are very active on this, talking about everything. And they, in terms of their level of freedom of speech, they'll criticize the government across all kinds of things, but China draws a line. So they'll let them talk about pollution and criticize the government in that respect. But when it comes to things like that get anywhere close to national security, then they start paying an interest. So there's the guy that was on trial earlier this week, who's the human rights lawyer. He was criticizing the government about their treatment of the Muslim population in the West. Now, he was rounded up, he was arrested, he was jailed, and now he's put on trial. So that there is a line where if you cross, they will focus on you. But that's not to say there's a lot of chatter going on in other areas as well. So, the internet is in China. It's a big thing in China. They can't kind of backpedal now. But I guess Xi Jinping is saying that it's not going to loosen up the approach that they take at the moment.
Ed, to bring you in, one of the other sort of low points of the Republican debate last night was a demonstration by eight grown adults that they didn't appear to have terribly much idea of how the internet actually works. But that aside, how important as a potential, I don't want to use the word battlefield, but, a possible arena of conflict between, which I realize now saying that out loud is exactly the same thing, between China and the United States is the online world. Xi Jinping was talking about wanting an international treaty on cyber terrorism and cyber counterterrorism. I mean, Is this going to be a thing, the United States versus China in the online realm?
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, it's curious to see how those two nations could ever agree to working together on cyber surveillance, cyber attacks, and cyber terrorism, the three words that the president used. Obviously, because the US accuses China of hacking into its computers with extremely sensitive information. So I don't really see how the US policy is going to change towards China, and China's going to, I'm sure, continue to deny it has anything to do with cyber espionage inside the US. So I think the two sides are going to remain at loggerheads over this issue. I really don't see how, the way it stands at the moment, both sides are going to be able to work together when it comes to cyber terrorism if one side is accused of carrying it out.
Okay, well, finally tonight, the moment I, for one, have been waiting for, we are going to consider the municipal politics of Barnaul, a city of 700,000 hardy souls huddled against the Ob River in western Siberia. Wearied of the corruption and incompetence of their local politicians, which is apparently bad enough to be noticeable even by Russian politicians' standards of corruption and incompetence, an overwhelming plurality of Barnaulites, as I've just decided they're called, in an unofficial online poll, have decided that their next mayor should be Barsik, an 18-month-old Scottish fold cat. James, ask you first of all. Their previous mayor, Igor Savintsev, has resigned over dodgy land deals. His son, Maxim, has skipped town for Thailand, just ahead of the law. In the circumstances, is electing a cat a reasonable response?
I feel like for cats, it must be the next step in their kind of, you know, and the next step up. You know, they're already internet sensations. They're very popular. So, you know, logically, they would run for elected office. So, you know, I think in the grand scheme of things, it's not such a ridiculous idea.
James welcomes our new cat overlords there. I mean, there are some precedents. I did look this up. I spent literally minutes researching this. The honorary mayor of Talkeetna, Alaska, has been a cat since 1997. A Labrador Rottweiler cross called Bosco was mayor of Sunol, California for 13 years. And Lajitas in Texas has had a succession of goat mayors. My favorite, though, this is true. In 1959 in Sao Paulo, Brazil, a rhinoceros called Casareco, I probably mispronounced that, apologies, was in fact elected to Sao Paulo's council. Ed, you know, America, the home of, you know, democracy run free. Is it a bad idea electing animals? An effective protest. There was a protest I noticed in Jalapa in Mexico. A cat called Morris was run that on the grounds that, like local politicians, he spent most of his time asleep.
They just like to get their paws in. Oh, I don't know. I was trying to think of a pun. It wasn't working. Anyway, I mean,
if it had been pigs, there's the whole snouts in the trough thing.
Well, maybe we can think of some before the end of the show. I think it's a good form of protest, but obviously, they're animals. I'm not sure that'd be great at governing.
I mean, I suppose the question is, being vaguely serious about this, you know,
try, please.
Well, you know, we talk about mayors and the mayoralty, you know, cities around the world a fair bit here at Monocle, and, you know, sort of making a protest is fine, but I suppose, you know, does it actually bring you to ask what a mayor should really do? And does that actually, after the cat has left office, does that mean...
Once the cat's out the bag.
Once the cat is out of the bag, nice and
Ed. Yeah,
nicely done. Does that actually mean that the actual, you know, human candidate successors sort of take the job more seriously and that it's a process refreshed? I don't know.
If you think about what the role of a mayor is... and, you know, in London, we have Boris Johnson, obviously, and he's put, he goes around the world, you know, representing London. This cat, not even been elected yet, and it's already made, you know, it's talking about this Siberian city that can't pronounce.
One way to get in the
gimmick,
news.
James. I mean,
you know, it has put Barnaul on the map. So even before he takes office, Mayor Barsik has done his city an enormous service, for which we must congratulate him. On that note, we will have to leave it there. Thomas Lewis, James Chambers, Ed Stocker, thank you very much for being here on this special edition of Midori House, which was produced by Carlotta Ribello, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Ilana Hanyukov. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Marcus Hippie is in for the next half hour with music from our international playlist. Daniel Giacopelli follows him with The Entrepreneurs at 1900. At 2200, Emma Nelson and Nancy Durham present the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition, it is goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.